For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
My name is Gyoshin Laurel, one of the priests here. I wanted to mention something about yesterday before I launch into this talk. So yesterday, some Sangha members from Ancient Dragon did something lovely. We had a service day at the Lakeview Food Pantry where two of our members, one of our members, Katie Dudzik, is an employee, and another one of our members, Alex Legg, was interested in organizing this. And I'm bringing it up because we thought it was such a wonderful experience that we will be trying to do that regularly, so maybe quarterly. And so the idea is to reach broadly to people who participate in Ancient Dragon. So watch out for announcements of that. And maybe next time you'd like to participate. I do have a little bit of a throat issue today, but I think I'm going to be okay. So when Taigen asked me to do this talk, I have to say I winced a little because I knew I was going to be just back from a long trip, and I really wasn't sure whether I had time to prepare anything. And since I can't really think about much more, I'm not room in my brain to think about much more than that travel experience, that's going to be the topic today. And I want to start by reading a poem. It's a little bit of a long poem, but I can't resist, so bear with me. This is a poem by Denise Levertov. She once said that writing poetry is her form of prayer. And the title of it is Sojourns in the Parallel World. We live our lives of human passions, cruelties, dreams, concepts, crimes, and the exercise of virtue, in and beside a world devoid of our preoccupations, free from apprehension, though affected certainly by our actions, a world parallel to our own, though overlapping. We call it nature, only reluctantly admitting ourselves to be nature too. Whenever we lose track of our own obsessions, our self-concerns, because we drift for a minute, an hour even, of pure, almost pure response to that insouciant life, cloud, bird, fox, the flow of light, the dancing pilgrimage of water, vast stillness of spellbound ephemera on a lit window pane, animal voices, mineral hum, wind conversing with rain, ocean with rock, stuttering of fire to coal. Then something tethered in us, hobbled like a donkey on its patch of gnawed grass and thistles, breaks free. No one discovers just where we've been when we're caught up again into our own sphere, where we must return indeed to evolve our destinies. But we have changed a little. So I had this immense privilege of spending 3 weeks in South Africa, which is an amazing and beautiful place. And we spent virtually all of our time in that parallel reality of nature. And I think I did manage to break free of my tether briefly. And man, I do feel like I've changed a little. So to start out by saying, I've never been to Africa before. I've done a fair amount of traveling. But I realized it's sort of funny that I've never been to Africa, because it's the very first place I ever remember as a young girl growing up in Youngstown, Ohio, that I really longed to visit. My mother was a big fan of Albert Schweitzer. I don't know if you know who he was, but he won the Nobel Peace Prize in the 50s. He worked in Africa, had a medical clinic in West Africa, and provided medical care to people there and actively opposed colonialism and on and on. And to my mother, it was really, really important that he was explicitly and publicly advocating for animals, his kindness to animals. And I hadn't thought about that for a long time, but I realized just now, after having been there, that Schweitzer was probably a strong influence on me. Mm-hmm. So I looked him up yesterday, and I found a couple of quotes that pretty much summarize the points I want to make in this talk. So one thing he said was, "Until he extends his circle of compassion to include all living things, man will not himself find peace." That sounds pretty Buddhist to me, even though he was a Lutheran. And he also said, "Man is a clever animal who behaves like an imbecile." So I try to clarify what I mean by those two things. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the trip. So also when I was a kid, we had National Geographic in our house, and you know, with the elephants and the wildebeests and the lions and stuff. And I distinctly remember seeing a picture in National Geographic, and probably on some black and white documentary on TV, of this bizarre creature called a secretary bird. And thinking that one day I really wanted to see a secretary bird. So last week I did. I saw secretary birds. And, you know, not in a zoo, but a wild birds, more than one. I'll just describe them. They're 4.5 feet tall. They have really long legs. And when you see them, you usually see them walking, not flying. They can fly, they nest in trees and stuff, but they haunt by walking, and they walk across grasslands. So they look sort of spookily like weird people, you know, because they're bipedal. And anyway, one of the ways they hunt is that they kick their prey to death. Big, strong feet. And Africans appreciate them because one of their preferred foods is snakes, so Africans don't harm secretary birds. So it was really exciting to, 60 years later, after I first saw them on TV, to actually see secretary birds. But they were only one of 367 species of birds that our little group of six Chicagoans saw. And that's a lot of biodiversity in 3 weeks, and it tells you something about South Africa. It's a very diverse, beautiful place with big areas set aside for habitat. And we had expert guides, you know, that took us to the right places to see them and helped us find them. And we had to go to different kinds of places. So we went to the Karoo, which is what they call their desert, and we went to the coastline, went to the forests and the grasslands, and ended up in the glorious savanna, where all the big animals are. But we're also working really hard to get this done. So it actually reminded me of Sesshin. So Sesshin, for new folks, these are our long meditation retreats where we start early in the morning and we pretty much sit all day and through the evening in silence and, you know, focusing on our practice, sometimes for one day, sometimes for 3 days. We'll be having a 5-day Sesshin in December. So on this trip, you know, we woke up early, we went out, we were out by 6 in the morning, and then we had breakfast at 9, and then we were out all morning, and then we had lunch, and then we were out all afternoon. And every evening at dinner before our meal, we sat with our list of species, and we went through it one by one, and we named every single thing that we had seen that day, and we put an X next to its name under that day. And sometimes we put an H. That was if we only heard it and we didn't see it. And I said we saw 367 kinds of fish. We also saw 53 different kinds of mammals and lots of reptiles. And but it was like a ritual. It was like a ceremony every day. I came home and I sort of missed it. I didn't want to, you know, we got a little tired, we got a little crabby, we got a little, but no one complained. And I really appreciated that. And of course, since no one complained, I didn't complain. Anyway, so if I want to torture this image of it being like Sistine just one more time, a little farther, I'll say, if I had a koan, I realized maybe halfway through the trip, it was not, does a secretary bird have Buddha nature? It was really, does Gyoshin Laurel have animal nature? Mm-hmm. Because we weren't just seeing these things, you know, with our binoculars. I felt like we were in their place and we were experiencing them in a very intimate way. You know, the birds were hunting and courting and taking care of their young and building their nests, and they all had different songs. And you know, the oxpeckers were on the backs of the rhinos picking off the ticks, and owls were sleeping in the day and they were hunting at night, and some birds were fishing and they were preening their feathers. And it was the third year of a drought, and so we saw a lot of animals and birds together at wetlands or watering places. And they seemed real and alive and behaving rationally. You know, it was their world and we were visiting. We were sort of neutral. We weren't, they're a little curious about us. We didn't have a lot of meaning to them because we weren't any threat. They knew that from experience, and we weren't anything to eat. So, you know, they were busy. They didn't have time to, like, look at us the way we were taking a vacation. We were looking at them. So, anyway, I mean, that with the mammals, the feeling of connecting to them as sentient beings was even more palpable. You know, we're mammals, and you look into the eyes of these animals, and we were very close. I mean, two different mama hyenas just lying there, suckling their babies. And, you know, I always thought of hyenas as nasty creatures. Oh, my gosh, these mamas were so lovely. I was completely in love with them. And we saw a male and female lion lying in each other's arms. They apparently had been mating over the last couple of days. And the guide said, oh, yes, that's the honeymoon couple. I really like that. We saw these vultures, big groups of all different kinds of vultures cleaning up kill sites. The very first day we were at Kruger Park, our guide said, look up there, and 20 feet in a big tree, 20 feet up, was a warthog hanging down. And then he said, well, look at the bottom of the tree. And there was a leopard guarding it. She had killed that warthog, carried it up the tree, stashed it there so the hyenas and jackals wouldn't, you know. And then she was happily sitting there. Anyway, so, and it was spring, so there was a lot of mating going on. The zebras were particularly flagrant, I'll tell you. So I loved it, and it, you know, the poem says, and it changes you, and I felt like it did change me. And I remember these books I had on my shelf that I had sort of read and sort of not read. I mean, you know how sometimes you read books and then you don't even remember what they were, even though you read them. It's like I didn't really get them, I think, when I read them, and then I got home and I thought, oh, those David Abram books. That's just what I want to read. So David Abram he's an anthropologist. He's also, I don't know if you've ever heard of eco-psychology. He's an eco-psychologist. It's a newly developed field. And he talks about this. So he talks about our senses in this book, The Spell of the Sensuous, which I really recommend. And then another one called Becoming Animal. And talks about connecting with and understanding ourselves as animals, not in a negative way in any way, in fact, in a very enriching way. I'll read you just a little of how he talks about it to give you a flavor. He says, to shut ourselves off from these other voices, to continue by our lifestyles to condemn these other sensibilities to the oblivion of extinction is to rob our own senses of their integrity and to rob our minds of their coherence. We are human only in contact and conviviality with what is not human. I love conviviality. Oh. Does the human intellect or reason really spring us free from our inherence in the depth of this wild proliferation of forms? Or on the contrary, is the human intellect rooted in and secretly born by our forgotten contact with the multiple non-human shapes that surround us on every hand? Anyway, he founded this organization called Alliance for Wild Ethics. The acronym is AWE. Great acronym. And anyway, if you're interested, it's pretty interesting, the stuff that they're doing and promoting. It's basically, you should call it education, to help us humans think a little bit more about the rest of life on Earth. And, you know, I wonder why our culture doesn't. I really do wonder that sometimes, why we're so about us, I'm going to change the subject slightly, but still the same subject. So whenever I have an experience like this, I remember Gary Snyder saying, so nature is not a place to visit, it is home. So I want to recommend a book about our home. This is a brand new book from UFC Press, and it's about Chicago, and it's called City Creatures. So you don't have to go to South Africa if you're interested in this. It's spectacular. It's essays, photographs, poems, paintings about other living things in the Chicago region. Very, very personal. The night before I left, I went to the party with this book coming. I was way too heavy to travel, so I only had time to skim it, but I'll read you what Amazon says about it. I think I agree with this from the small amount of time I've had to spend with it. We usually think of cities as the domain of humans, but we are just one of thousands of species that call the urban landscape home. Chicago residents knowingly move among familiar creatures like squirrels, pigeons, and dogs, but might be surprised to learn about all the leafhoppers and water bears, black-crowned night herons and bison, beavers and Massasauga rattlesnakes that are living alongside them. So if you're interested, I'm gonna buy one of these and donate it to the Ancient Dragon Library. I think it's really a wonderful book. But there's an exhibit right now at the Peggy Notabart Nature Museum, which is in Lincoln Park. It's just north of the Lincoln Park Zoo. And it has a lot of the images that are in here. And I think I would recommend it as an experience. So anyway, that's about all I want to say. I want to end with another of my favorite Buddhist, Albert Einstein, just a little quote. He says, "Our task must be to free ourselves by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature and its beauty." And I hope that we can all do more of that. Thank you very much. And I'd love to hear your thoughts and experiences, either on what I was talking about or especially with new people, any other thing that you'd like to bring up. This is a perfectly appropriate time to ask questions or... Yes?
You forgot to mention the rats. No, I'm sorry.
That's a very
funny. Where I work, I constantly see them. So that's
where do you work? Yeah, no, I didn't forget to. I didn't mention everything.
Well, I want to thank you for going to Africa. That's got to be an amazing experience. I was just talking about Africa, South Africa, with my boss last night. He's going. My question to you is that he's thinking about moving over there.
Yeah.
And I was a, he asked me, he said, do you think it's Zen or Buddhism over there? Do you think, is it possible that is there a sitting group in West Africa, in South Africa? Or did you realize that? Is there an opportunity for that?
So I don't know the answer to that question, but I'll just say that what we didn't do and what I dearly would love to do would be to actually spend more time in the cities with the people there, because the small amount of interaction that we did have with the people was really wonderful and really interesting. You could only do so much in 3 weeks, and this is what we wanted to do. I would be surprised if there weren't, because there are major cities, and I don't know, does anyone else know of any? Do you know of any cities?
I don't know specifically, but within the last year, a book came out. It was the sort of public collection of correspondence between Gary Snyder and the South African woman over a course of about 30 years. She was very interested in Zen. And she, I remember there were references in there to her talking about sitting with her friends.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I don't know where you would start, but I can't. I mean, it's a big country, right? I just have to.
With many major cities,
yeah.
And very culturally diverse, so.
Yeah. You know, I've never, you know, I have to admit, like when I'm perusing the back of like Chrysler Magazine, you know, Zen groups in California and Midwest, I haven't looked for Africa. I mean, I checked it out.
Yeah, I was thinking about it. I mean, it's much needed. It could be, I mean, Zen and the practicing. The whole world can use it, so I'm sure it could be utilized in Africa. It's just got to have someone over there.
Right. And I don't know anything about your boss, but, I mean, he could always start a sitting room. That's what a lot of people do if they can't find one right away. I think that's how this place happened. Oh, sorry, Jane.
You know what? I appreciate the teeming with life and the springtime, because the things that I hear about now are like the rhinos and the elephants and all the poaching, and people have been studying elephant language for 30 years, and there's going to be like no elephants in a minute. I mean, they're really going extinct. So I appreciated the fact that they were all mating and teeming with life. I think that might exclude the elephants in them.
So we did hear a lot about those kinds of things. So we were in several parks, but I'll only talk about Kruger, which is the very, very large park in the northeast that borders on Mozambique. We were like 5 minutes from Mozambique at one point. And there is a lot of poaching of rhinos and elephants in particular, which I knew. What I didn't know, so we had these great guides who grew up there, and they speak like three native languages plus English and Afrikaans, and they're just amazing people, and they know every blade of grass in this immense park. So the way they talk about the poaching is so discouraging. They say, oh, everyone knows who the poachers are. They're just paying people off. And it could get fixed in a minute if we didn't have such corrupt government. Mm-hmm. And the casualness of these, and, you know, they didn't have any reason to say that to us. They're saying with their own broken hearts this. We actually saw one elephant who had this giant sore around her leg because she had been caught in a snare, and yeah, these guys are so somehow she pulled the snare out of wherever it was and was walking around with the snare in her leg, and the park guards darted her and took the snare off, but then she had this wound that was horrifying. That stuff is hard. It's really hard. I mean, one thing I say to myself is one good thing about being a, you know, tourist is we bring value to those resources that helps maybe, you know, financial value. I'm not talking about the kind of value I was talking about earlier that might bear some weight to mean that that's one reason that so many large places are set aside, because there is value to people. But of course, it's very complicated, and I don't pretend to understand it. Only can say what impressions were in a very brief visit. I mean, one of the guys said he grew up under apartheid, and he thought that his schools were better than his children's schools. Mm-hmm. Well, that was horrifying to hear. So I don't know. I could just take it at face value and not really know, what his metrics were to make that decision. But I mean, that make that statement. I started out by saying something about the service day. I'm not sure what we're going to call them, whatever we did yesterday at the food pantry. And I'm hoping that one time we can have a volunteer service day out in the forest preserves and actually go out and do some stuff in nature together. That's really fun. And there's lots of great work we can do with invasive species or seed collecting or whatever the season is that we decide to do. So try to arrange that too. We could even do it maybe along the river, which is pretty close here, where they have a lot of volunteer stewardship. Asia.
Thank you so much for your talk and all the different areas that you encompass, whether it's the service day yesterday or your travels or your experience with nature or your experience with nature in the city. I am so, just kind of taking away from your talk my own awareness of all the ways in which we can bring a spirit of practice to different things in our life. Whether that is, I know you've done, walking sessions where you'll walk all day, and I would love to hear more about that sometime. I may have missed a Dharma talk that you've done about that, but I was in Door County last week, and biking around, we put our bicycles on the ferry and went over to Washington Island and biked around the island for the day. And I was thinking about how when I'm in nature, it always gets me back in touch with how you can live with very little, and use your ingenuity and find ways to be in harmony with your environment. And so many wonderful, things that we can learn about ourselves or just get reminded of about our lives. And how I loved the poem, in that it makes something explicit that I never really thought about, how we feel like we're living in this parallel universe, but really we are, we are nature and we are traffic. And so I really want to find more ways for all of us to support each other in bringing our practice to different aspects of life. I am hoping to find a way to organize a camping session for next year or the year after, where we camp, we sit outside and really take in that experience of the natural world. And it doesn't, because practice can just be a frame, for helping us encounter things. It doesn't have to be, upholding the forms for their own sake. It's a way of being in the world that we can bring to all different parts of our life. And so I look forward to all of us together, finding ways to make that happen.
I think that's a wonderful idea. Sign me up.
That's awesome.
Yes.
Thank you for the nice talk, Laurel. I want to thank you for pointing out the connection between nature outside us and nature within us, or the animal or the wild outside us and the wild within us, because I find, like, in my own practice, sometimes it's easy to recognize that I can't control my external, you know, conditions and circumstances, but I think it's a much more difficult realization to see that there's also a lot going on inside that I can't control. Mm-hmm. I just have to sort of accept the way it is. So thank you for pointing that out.